Greetings, and welcome to Research on Religion, a weekly podcast series devoted to the social scientific study of religion. I'm Anthony Gill, your host, professor of political science at the University of Washington, and distinguished senior fellow at Baylor University's Institute for Studies of Religion, the gracious sponsor of our podcast. We encourage you to visit our website at www.researchonreligion.org to post comments, ask questions, access additional material related to today's program, and to find out what is happening at the Institute. All right, let's begin.
They're here. Ghosts, Bigfoot, alien visitors from other worlds, the Loch Ness Monster. Whether or not these creatures really do walk amongst us, for millions of Americans and others around the world, these things are real. And despite living in an age that is supposedly ruled by science, with its strong criteria for empirical validation, belief in the supernatural and paranormal is widespread, provoking many individuals to devote a substantial portion of their daily lives to such activities as UFO clubs, or paying substantial sums of money to visit fortune tellers and mediums. While this podcast series is principally devoted to the study of conventional faith traditions such as Christianity, Islam, Judaism, Hinduism, and other well-known religions, I thought it'd be worthwhile to examine what most people would consider to be fringe beliefs in the paranormal. In actuality, these fringe beliefs may be more mainstream than many of us suspect. Recent survey research indicates a strong majority of Americans believe in some aspect of the paranormal, be it ghosts, ESP, astrological charts, the healing power of crystals, or the existence of extraterrestrial visitors. The popularity of shows like Ghost Whisperer, Monster Quest, or UFO Hunters is further indication that there is at least some level of widespread interest in these topics. In many respects, and speaking for the moment from the vantage point of a social scientist, belief in the paranormal has its similarities with more conventional religions, such as having to rely upon one's faith that something exists beyond the realm of our empirical senses. Moreover, many people come to believe in the paranormal after having experienced some dramatic event that could be considered akin to a conversion experience, whereas others merely started to dabble in the topic out of a desire to find greater enlightenment. And of course, we are coming up on Halloween here in the United States, and I'm not beyond using that day to spur greater interest in this podcast. To help us make sense of the paranormal, particularly with respect to who believes and why, I've invited Christopher Bader, professor of sociology at Baylor University, to join us. Chris is an expert in criminology and the sociology of religion, and has authored dozens of articles on these topics. Chris is also the co-principal director of the Baylor Survey of Religious Values and Behavior, as well as being the manager of web development at the Association of Religious Data Archives, a wonderful resource for those who are interested in religion, and I hope to talk about that a little bit at the end of today's episode. Chris is currently the co-author of several recent books, including America's Four Gods with Paul Froese, and we'll be talking with him in coming weeks. And more importantly, for today's topic, he has written the book Paranormal America, Ghost Encounters, UFO Sightings, Bigfoot Hunts, and Other Curiosities in Religion and Culture, just released with NYU Press and co-authored with his colleagues Carson Mencken and Joseph Baker. We'll put up links to those books and the website associated with Paranormal America on our website, so you can check those out. Chris, welcome to Research on Religion.
Hey, thanks for having me, Tony.
My first question is not so much about the content of the books or the findings of your research, but rather what motivated you to take up this topic. Having been in the academic culture for several decades, I can only imagine that many people would consider a study of UFO groups and Bigfoot and other things like that to be somewhat frivolous. So what got you into this?
Sure. As far as what motivated me to study this topic, it's a complicated story, as most of our interests are. I grew up in the Pacific Northwest, which is supposedly home to Bigfoot, and so I grew up with Bigfoot being part of the popular culture up there, and was one of those kids who thought Bigfoot might live in his backyard. So I had that interest growing up, that curiosity growing up, but really, I set that aside for quite a few years until I started delving into sociology and then started to become interested in how the paranormal can essentially impact religion and culture. And so I treat it as a sociological interest, not as a personal interest these days. But I would agree with you that that it is a danger when you're studying the paranormal that people will simply think of it as a frivolous subject or think of the subject as not worth pursuing. And I would say in a certain sense there's no winning that argument, because the paranormal is treated as a silly subject in the news.
Right.
When Halloween comes around, we're going to see every newscast ending with a wacky story about the latest ghost sighting, a wacky story about the latest Bigfoot hunt. But I can make a pitch for essentially the relative importance of the subject.
And please do.
The reason I think that the paranormal is worth studying is for several reasons. The first is simply the ubiquity of belief in the paranormal. As we'll probably talk about later, the paranormal is a subject that Americans find important. Most Americans believe in something, in some sort of paranormal subject. And because of the ubiquity of the belief, I think it's important to try to understand what effect it has on our culture, and particularly what effect it has on a couple of important institutions in our culture. The first, I would say, is religion. And as you mentioned in your opening comments, there's a lot of similarities between religion and the paranormal.
Mm-hmm.
The paranormal is based on belief in things unseen. It's oftentimes motivated by experiences that I would say are akin to religious experiences. And so the question that comes up when I'm thinking about religion and the paranormal is, how similar is the paranormal to religion? And is, in fact, the paranormal affecting religion in any way? One possibility in that sense is that the paranormal is very different from religion in the sense that it lacks the level of organization mm-hmm. that most religious groups do. The paranormal is more ephemeral, more loosely organized than most religious groups and denominations. But what's possible is that these paranormal beliefs will eventually organize into more coherent and more denominational forms. And we have started to see that, where some UFO beliefs and some UFO groups have started to form into what we would consider religious denominations. And so the paranormal can possibly impact the future of religion. It can be a wellspring from which new religious movements form, or from which new ideas come that are then that then merge into religious movements.
And that idea is not so far off. I'm sure many people listening, and I think myself included in this, would say, "Oh, you know, come on, this has been around for a while. That really hasn't been a wellspring of any religions." But there have been some, the guy in France who then set up a religion in Canada, and then also thinking of Heaven's Gate. I mean, there's several examples of where this really starts to become more institutionalized.
Absolutely. There's numerous examples of now certainly I would not make the argument that that there has been any group that has sprung from the paranormal in the last 40 years that has truly had a massive impact on the religious marketplace. There are several groups out there, such as Unarius and the Aetherius Society, that are long-lived groups based on UFO beliefs. I think that what may happen is that we shouldn't be looking with a window for 20 years or 40 years.
Mm-hmm.
We should be thinking about the possibility that these types of beliefs will have a very long-term impact, that the ideas from the paranormal may become incorporated into mainstream religions, may impact mainstream religions, and eventually may start to draw some people away from mainstream religions.
Mm-hmm.
But this is not something that is, as we know, with developments in the religious marketplace, oftentimes these developments are not something that we see over the course of 20 years.
Mm-hmm.
But I also think that the paranormal can be important in terms of understanding religion, in that increasing interest in the paranormal could perhaps be a sign of decreasing interest in organized religious groups. That one of the big debates within the sociology of religion, of course, is the nuns, N-O-N-E, that the percentage of people in our country that claim to have no religious affiliation is rising over time. The exact amount of that rise is in debate, and what that exactly means is in debate. But what is clear is that people are more willing to express their spirituality and religiosity in less organized forms. And one of the ways that they can do that is by playing around with the paranormal.
Mm-hmm.
But I would say that I'm sure we'll come back to religion quite a bit, of course, but I think that the paranormal is also important for understanding credulity. Frankly, that whether academics find the subject of the paranormal silly or not, the general public doesn't. It matters to people, and what we're finding is that people who have an increasing interest in the paranormal have a decreasing interest in science. They don't believe that science is providing the answer to these mysterious phenomena that they're interested in. And so it's very interesting to study the paranormal to see if this is impacting people's skepticism in general, people's attitudes towards science in general, people's attitudes towards institutional institutions in all forms. And because I have an interest in criminology and deviance, I also find the paranormal a fantastic place to explore the general issue of deviant behavior and to test theories of deviance. Because really, despite the fact there is a ubiquity of belief in the paranormal, one thing that's very interesting is if you get people to admit it, they will admit that they believe in some paranormal subject. Yet in public, if you happen to be the person that admits that you've seen Bigfoot, you're the subject of scorn and people will make fun of you and assume that you're crazy. So there's an interesting dual relationship with the paranormal in our culture. And so it fascinates me to understand how people who have these paranormal experiences or believe in paranormal things hide their behavior, how they justify their behavior. And in that sense, all the classic theories of deviance come into play.
Mm-hmm.
So I wouldn't make the argument, and I would never try to convince people that the paranormal is something that every sociologist should drop what they're doing and go spend their time chasing UFOs. What I would say is that it's something that's important to people. It affects their attitudes in a number of realms. It affects their religious behaviors and attitudes. And so I think quality studies of the paranormal we should be doing those in the sociology of religion. What we don't need is a lot of sociologists going out and doing fieldwork studies of small religious cults and writing long books about them. And that's what, unfortunately, a lot of the research on the paranormal has been. What we need is to try to understand the paranormal and its place in our culture.
Yeah, your book really looks at it in a broader perspective. And I have to gauge in a little confession here is that, you know, when I originally scheduled this podcast, I approached it with a degree of frivolity. And as I picked up your manuscript and started reading it, I was really impressed on how well you dealt with this topic in a very serious manner. And on top of it, you took the subjects that you were studying in a very serious manner. In fact, the most interesting part of the book, or one of the more interesting parts of the book, was actually the preface or the acknowledgments, where you thank a number of people for helping you with this study. And as you read the book and you find out these people are not nuts, they're not crazy. There are many colorful characters in the book, but there's certainly this is a picture of mainstream America, not some strange far off groups that we might never encounter in our daily lives. These are people that we see around every day.
I would agree with you there, and I think that's the way that we end the book actually is by saying whether we like it or not. The paranormal is here to stay, and that was one of the surprising things that we found is just how ubiquitous these beliefs are, and you're right that I've always said that the paranormal wouldn't be interesting if it was simply crazy people doing crazy things.
Mm-hmm.
That's not an interesting subject for me to pursue. What's interesting about the paranormal is it is becoming a part of normal everyday life, and people who are very normal on any sort of indicator you want to use are engaging in this behavior. And so, again, I think it's important to understand who these people are, what effect it has on their lives, what effect it has on religion or other institutions.
And I should mention that there's a great deal of interest in this topic among the general public, as well as even some in academia. A little known fact here, you are the first guest on Research on Religion to be requested. So I actually had somebody call me up and say, hey, you got to get Chris Bader on the show because it'd be really good. It would surprise you who it is, but I'm not going to tell you who it is. But nobody at Baylor, actually, by the way. So this is outside. But let's talk about who engages in the belief of the paranormal and as well as practices, because later on in the book you talk about there's differences just between belief or dabbling in it. And I'll have to confess that as a kid I've always been fascinated with UFOs, I think because I grew up watching Star Trek and that, and when UFO Hunters comes on the History Channel, I'm not sure why it's on the History Channel, but it is, I tune in, and I just think it's really fascinating. So there's this part of me that says, yeah, I like in the X-Files, I want to believe, or something along that. So, I might be considered in part of this group that has some interest in this topic. But we were talking earlier about this group of nones, N-O-N-E-S. These are people who do not claim any conventional religious affiliation. And I know Mark Silk and his American Religious Identification Survey has done research on this, as well as your survey on religion at Baylor. And what have you found about the nones? I think the initial idea is that when somebody says, well, I have no affiliation with religion, we automatically assume that they're atheist or agnostic. Right. But who makes up this nuns category?
Sure, and I think that's the biggest misunderstanding that people have about that nuns category, is that by saying nun, you are in fact an atheist. And in fact, it's a very small percentage of that nuns category that are truly atheists. And how I define an atheist is someone who says, I believe in nothing beyond the physical world.
Mm-hmm.
And what we find, in fact, is that most of those nuns do believe in God, for example, do believe in have had a religious experiences, do pray, do read a holy book, or experiment with the paranormal. So most nuns are the best way to put them is disaffiliated. That they have not found a religious group that they like. They have been become disenchanted with the religious group they may have belonged to at one time. So the nuns really are people who are essentially in play. Most of them are a pool from which religious groups might draw new members. A small percentage of those nuns are in fact very strict Christians who you might say would drift into a non-denominational group.
Mm-hmm.
That was one of the interesting things that we found in the Baylor survey, is that a small percentage of those nuns are in fact people who believe very strongly in Satan, think the Bible is a literal document, but yet they are not currently associated with any of the larger religious organizations. So that is a varied group. But I will say that those nuns are the group that is one of the most likely to be interested in and believe in the paranormal as well. That they're a group of people who essentially their religious capital is not currently tied to a specific organization that's telling them what to believe in. And that makes them relatively free to explore and experiment with the paranormal.
Yeah, so let's switch out in terms of talking not so much about the nuns, but rather those individuals who do believe in the paranormal. Let's first start out by getting a broad-based picture of how many people in the United States, based upon your survey research and others, show some degree of belief or interest in the paranormal.
Sure, and this is one of the things that we do in the book that hasn't been done before, that previous research on the paranormal has tended to focus on one or two subjects. And so it's been very difficult from previous research to get any real grasp on how many Americans or what percentage of Americans believe in the paranormal, because a survey here will ask about UFOs, a survey there will ask about ESP. They've been asked of regional samples and religious samples. So what we did on the Baylor survey, which the book is based largely on findings from the Baylor survey, is ask about a very broad range of paranormal beliefs and experiences. So we asked about belief in Atlantis or other lost civilizations, belief in telekinesis or other psychic powers, belief in astrology, belief in mediums or speaking with the dead, belief in ghosts, belief in monsters such as Bigfoot and the Loch Ness Monster, belief that we're going to experience some sort of radical new age at some time in the near future. And by asking all those questions, what we find is that in fact 68% of Americans believe in something paranormal.
Mm-hmm.
Now, again, this is what we can get at by asking broad-based questions, that there are a lot of people in this country, and this is one of the things we found when we were talking to people, that find the idea of UFOs ridiculous and find the idea of astrology silly and think that psychics are frauds. That you ask them about Bigfoot and they say, oh yes, I think there's a Bigfoot. And so what we find in the U.S. is not so much skepticism about the paranormal, but particularistic skepticism,
mm-hmm.
that they believe in something. You just have to find what it is. And when you ask a broad range of questions, you find that most Americans, in fact, do believe in the paranormal.
Mm-hmm.
It's just that they believe in one or two or three things and don't find the rest very credible. You know, we do find a few patterns in general as far as who believes in certain types of topics.
Let me, before you get there, let me stop and ask you just a question about the range of beliefs. And this is something that is might be a sensitive topic for some Christians who have deep-held beliefs. But I want to think about the range of the activities you talked about. You talked about Atlantis and telekinesis and ghosts and stuff. What about something like angels?
Sure. We do have a chapter in the book about angels, about possession, possession by demons or devils, about belief in the ability to speak in tongues. And those subjects are frankly messy, and we admit as such in the book, because the paranormal as we define it are these topics that are not yet accepted by science and not yet accepted by religion. So they're in this middle, this strange middle ground.
Right.
Whereas most Christian groups, most of the major religions in this country do not have as part of their doctrine belief in UFOs or Bigfoot or ESP, astrology, etc. And most scientists would say that even if they're interested, that those things are not real. Whereas there's some of these topics that are on the fringes. And I would count possession and belief in guardian angels as two of those topics where you find a lot of interest in those subjects amongst people who are into the paranormal but really have no interest in Christianity. And obviously you find a lot of interest in those topics amongst some of the stricter Christian groups.
Mm-hmm.
The thing I'll say about angels is that's the big crossover experience. 52% of people in this country believe they've been saved from harm by a guardian angel. So a paranormalist is likely to believe in that, as well as a Christian. And you find, in fact, one of the ways that I find that's interesting for trying to understand what is paranormal and what is religion is just to go to a bookstore. Booksellers know a lot about who's buying what books.
Right.
And you find that books about guardian angels and books about possession by demons end up in both categories, both the Christian book section and the paranormal book section. They just have different perspectives on the matter. A Christian who is interested in guardian angels will see that as evidence of God's favor, evidence of God's love. A Christian who's interested in possession will talk about possession as one of the dangers that you face if you aren't leading the right life or if you're getting involved in the occult. Whereas in the paranormal, you'll find them talking about those same topics, but talking about them just in the sense of one more thing in this giant cafeteria of the paranormal, which is interesting. So, and there are different patterns, and I can talk about those if you'd like, between people who will believe in these topics I've defined as the paranormal and people who will believe in these border topics such as guardian angels and possession.
Yeah, let's talk about that. Let's move into that area now in terms of, you know, thinking specifically what demographic characteristics or other types of characteristics people who believe in the paranormal might have. I mean, are we talking that people who are deeply affiliated with religion in the conventional sense, are they more likely or are they less likely to believe in the paranormal? Are there some other distinctions that need to be made here?
Sure, and that was, again, another one of the findings in the book that hasn't been addressed before, is that a lot of research has looked at the relationship between religion and the paranormal, and the funny thing about it is that there's been three arguments made about what the relationship between religion and the paranormal will be, and all three of them are wrong. There's a body of research out there that suggests that religion will be negatively related to the paranormal. In other words, if you're religious, you're not going to be interested in the paranormal. The argument being that religion is soaking up all of your religious capital, and you won't have essentially space to engage in the paranormal. There's been just as many studies out there or theorists who have argued that the two should be positively related to each other, because religion is a sign of credulity, and if you'll believe in God, you'll believe in anything. So therefore, someone who's religious should also believe in ghosts and aliens. And then another body of research has suggested there should be no relationship because they simply occupy separate cultural spheres. What we found in the book is that none of those possible answers are correct, and in fact, there's a curvilinear relationship between the two, and previous research has simply misspecified their models. What I mean by a curvilinear relationship is that the greatest interest in the paranormal is amongst marginally religious people. That the most likely person in terms of religion to be possibly experimenting with UFOs or Bigfoot or Ouija boards or ESP on the side is someone who believes that the Bible should not be taken literally, or is someone who attends, say, once a month or less, is someone who believes in God but doesn't believe in a very angry personified God, and is someone who is most likely a member of a mainline Christian group. The person who's the least likely to believe in the paranormal is someone who is in a very strict Christian group, and that's for several reasons. And after that, the least likely person is someone who doesn't believe in anything, someone who simply is not religious at all. So what you see is this big curve, that you have to have some interest in spiritual matters to have an interest in the paranormal. So people who are simply not religious at all have no interest. But as you get towards very strict religions, as you get to people who are investing more and more in a certain type of strict religion, that interest in the paranormal tails off.
Now, why would that be? I mean, you mentioned that strict Christian groups, for obvious reasons, would not have members interested in the paranormal. What might those reasons be?
Sure, there's a couple of reasons. One, I do think there's a lot of merit to the argument that that when you're in a strict religious group, what strict religious groups do is have restrictions and requirements that help weed out free riders, help weed out the marginal members who are going to essentially drag down the overall level of commitment. And if you are experimenting with other spiritual beliefs on the side, that's a sign that you have a low level of commitment. You can't be out proselytizing for your group or helping clean up the church on Sunday or running Sunday school if you've got to hurry up and get out to your Bigfoot hunt.
Right.
And so one reason is simply that when people make a commitment to a group, they start to decrease their interest in other beliefs. But there's a more direct reason than that, that you find that religious groups talk differently about the paranormal at different levels of strictness. In the very liberal Christian groups, you actually find encouragement to play with the paranormal. If you ever go to a Unitarian church, look at their bulletin board, and they'll have advertisements for astrologers or advertisements for the local New Age fair, in addition to advertisements for Buddhists and Hindus, etc. In the mainline groups, there's simply just no concern. Most mainline Christian groups don't have a concern about the paranormal. They don't talk about it. They're not worried about what you're doing on the side. What you find in a lot of the stricter Christian groups, and we do have interviews with some people talking about this in the book, is a message that the New Age and the occult, the paranormal, is actually dangerous. That we talk to many members of strict Christian groups who don't just think that the Bigfoot and UFOs and such are not worth your time, or are taking your time away from the church, or are silly. They'll actually talk about those things being manifestations of Satan.
Mm-hmm.
That if you go to a Christian bookstore, particularly a conservative Christian bookstore, and look in their occult or paranormal section, you'll find books that suggest that UFOs are in fact Satan's chariots. That's the name of one book that I have in my collection. You'll find books that say that Bigfoot is in fact a demon. You'll find books that suggest that playing with Ouija boards or psychic powers is a gateway into being possessed. So there's actually a narrative in those groups that's explicitly against the paranormal, which serves to decrease that belief and experimentation.
Right. Let me go ahead and ask you about different types of... Well, before I do that, let me back up and say, are there any other types of characteristics of that make people more likely to believe in the paranormal, such as, is there a gender difference? Are there age differences? Is it working class? Is it rich people? Who dabbles in this stuff?
Sure, that's no problem. We do find some demographic characteristics that are very strong predictors of belief in the paranormal, and one is gender, that females are more likely to believe in nearly every paranormal topic except for UFOs. And to be honest, I haven't quite figured out why UFOs are a male topic. But males are more likely to believe in UFOs than females. But otherwise, females are more likely to believe in everything. And the gender difference in the paranormal pretty much mirrors the gender difference we find in religion in general, in mainstream religion. That females are more likely to attend with greater frequency, more likely to be religious than males. They're also more likely to be paranormal. We do find a few the race effects are fairly minimal, although African Americans are more likely to believe in ghosts and monsters. So the most likely person in this country to believe in Bigfoot, believe it or not, is a female African American.
Really?
Is most likely to say, yeah, there could be a Bigfoot out there. But I think the biggest stereotype that we've somewhat overturned in this book is the idea that the paranormal is the province of uneducated low-income people, and that's simply not the case. The education effects are minimal, and the you cannot predict that someone is going to or not going to believe in the paranormal simply by knowing their education. In fact, I've interviewed many PhDs who think they've been abducted by aliens. So it's not the province of education, and education will not remove interest in the paranormal. The only topics where there is an education effect, and it's rather small, is if you have a lower level of education, you're more likely to frequent psychics, believe in astrology, and slightly more likely to believe in ghosts. But in all these other subjects, such as UFOs and Bigfoot and ESP, belief in Atlantis, belief in a forthcoming new age, there are no education effects that people across the board show an interest in these subjects.
I have to toss out a hypothesis about males believing in UFOs more, because this is something that reading your book is bringing back growing up in the 1970s for me as a lad who was very much into science fiction. Star Wars and Star Trek and mm-hmm. Buck Rogers and stuff. And I think I developed a fascination with UFOs there because I just like the Star Trek storyline that there's going to be some Klingons coming down, and it seems that UFOs or extraterrestrial visitors are kind of get into issues more of war, that we're going to have alien invaders coming in. Especially I love the 1950s and 60s movies where the alien invaders were here to crush the earth and we had to fight back, and that's I think in many ways very different than some of these other issues where you tend to have more spiritual aspects of communing with the dead or communing with ghosts and a much more empathetic
that's a good point
type of feeling.
You're right, and that's one of the issues that we really didn't have the ability to address in this book, which I think is one that's worth for other sociologists to study, is essentially cultural ideas that serve as a genesis for these beliefs,
right.
And finding out if people who are interested in certain subjects such as UFOs have in fact been reading science fiction,
mm-hmm.
And if the fiction that you read growing up impacts what types of paranormal beliefs you have later is I think an interesting topic.
Well, one of the other things that I found interesting in your book is how a number of these beliefs tend to be related. Now, you mentioned before that a lot of times we see very particularistic beliefs, that there will be people who are very intrigued by Bigfoot, but if you ask them about ghosts, they'll say, well, that's silly. What,
right.
Chasing ghosts is silly. I'm going off to my Bigfoot hunt now. Are there any general patterns of relationships between belief? If I believe in UFOs, am I more likely to believe in Bigfoot? If I believe in ghosts, am I more likely to see a psychic or a medium?
Well, there are a few patterns such as that there are clusters in the sense that people who believe in one, I make a distinction in the book between people who use the paranormal as a form of enlightenment or a form of discovery. And what I mean by enlightenment is that we met many people in these circles who view the paranormal as a way to better themselves, to increase their personal power in some way, to be able to improve their lives by being able to predict if they're going to get a job or get some sort of supernatural insight on how to proceed in a relationship. And then there's a group of people into the paranormal for discovery, which is about trying to discover some new form of life, some new animal, some new creature from another planet. And I would include amongst that belief in Bigfoot, belief in UFOs, and those types of people do tend to have some interesting differences, and you find that the beliefs tend to cluster. In other words, someone who believes in Bigfoot is somewhat more likely to believe in UFOs.
Mm-hmm.
And someone who believes in one form of personal enlightenment, such as psychic powers, does show a slight tendency to believe in other sorts of personal enlightenment, such as viewing your astrological charts or viewing your auras, those types of things. But more generally, I can speak about, if you'd like, is one of the most important distinctions that we found in the book, and one of the source of misunderstandings about who believes in the paranormal, is the idea of being a particularist or a generalist. And we found very strong differences between people who believe in one paranormal topic and one only, and people who are more treating the paranormal as one giant cafeteria. in the sense that people, I use the example of Laura and David in the book, and David is a particularist. He believes he's seen Bigfoot and is out to discover Bigfoot and prove to the world that he's not crazy. And the interesting thing about David is that in every other aspect of his life, he's extremely conventional. That if you don't get him talking about Bigfoot, you will never know that he's any different from anyone else. He's very conservative religiously. He's got a very mainstream job at a bank. He runs a bank, actually. He has a higher level of education. He was in the military. He has very conservative political beliefs. He completely shatters the stereotype we have of someone who's interested in the paranormal as some sort of person sitting around their tie-dye shirt on the beach trying to commune with aliens and waiting for ghosts to show up.
Right.
But then you have Laura, who I could have filled 5 sheets of paper and never finished with a list of the things that she believes in and she's experienced. She believes she has psychic powers. She believes she's had multiple past lives. She believes she's from another planet. At the same time, she believes aliens have come and taken her to their spaceship. She's a Buddhist. She has a shaman. She also is a Christian at the same time. She holds all of these beliefs simultaneously somehow. And what's interesting about her is that she is just very unconventional. And she would describe herself as such. This is not me insulting Laura by saying this, but she lives a very unconventional life. She lives out in a trailer by herself in a room filled with dream catchers and books of all different types of religion. She proudly describes herself as a nature worshiper who's as liberal as they come. She is not working. She's had multiple husbands and currently divorced and perhaps going to live with someone soon. So none of those characteristics are meant to be insults. It's just meant to be that these two people live very different lives. Laura leads a very proudly unconventional life and sees the paranormal as just one part of her life. And frankly, she could care less whether you believe her or not, and has no interest in trying to make her beliefs sound more reasonable to you. Whereas David leads an extremely conventional life and is almost trapped by his belief in Bigfoot. He believes he's seen Bigfoot and has to prove to himself and others that he's not crazy. And so he's defensive about his belief, he's somewhat embarrassed about his belief, and he is trying to prove constantly to the world that what he saw was objectively real. And so amongst someone like David, who believes in one paranormal belief, you'll find those people oftentimes to be extremely conventional in all characteristics, their religious characteristics, their educational and income characteristics. The more paranormal belief someone believes in, the more unconventional they tend to be. That being unconventional, not being tied to a very conventional job, not being tied to a conventional religion, not being tied to conventional relationships, this is classic deviance theory, essentially frees you to engage in all sorts of behaviors that you might be restrained from engaging in otherwise.
Mm-hmm. One of the things, and this is a nice segue, talking about Laura and David here, one of the things I really enjoyed about your book is that at one level you do a nice quantitative survey that looks at the broad panoply of different types of paranormal beliefs, and looked at across a wide swath of the American population. But on the other hand, you do field work. You get down and do some qualitative digging in the dirt, and you blend these two very well in the book. It's not just, here's my chapter on quantitative, here's my chapter on qualitative. The book reads really well. You take us to who's all believing this, and then all of a sudden we have this very interesting story that just grabs your attention, and then you bring it back to more generalities. So I really recommend people to pick up this book. It's a very good read. But tell us about the field work, because that's the part that I thought was really fantastic in here. The survey research, again, is fantastic. We're learning a lot of things about, you know, patterns in the larger population. But in order to understand not only who is doing this in terms of general characteristics of age and income level and education, you actually are with these folks. You've been to a haunted coffee house, you've attended Bigfoot conventions and gone on a Bigfoot hunt and that. So tell us a little bit about that field research that you did.
Sure, and I think that I do try to, in all my work when I can, combine field work and quantitative work, because I think the field work's really important for trying to understand how people frame their own beliefs and their own activity.
Right.
And so you're right. And what I've tried to do over time is spend time with paranormal believers and people who've experienced the paranormal, so I can try to get a sense of how this fits into their lives, how they justify what they're doing, how they explain their behaviors, and frankly, to get a sense of what these people are like and if they do fit the stereotypes, if this is just a nutty person who's just had one more nutty experience. And so I've been on several Bigfoot hunts. I've spent the night in haunted houses. I've gone to psychic fairs and had my palms read and my aura photographs taken. And
it turns out you're an orange person.
That's right. I'm an orange person with a protective spirit around me as well. So that's I guess that's comforting. And I've learned some very unique things doing this field work. For example, I would never have gotten a sense of what, for example, these Bigfoot hunters are really like if I didn't spend time with them in the field and follow them around and watch what they do. And so one of the chapters in the book does detail our time with members of the Texas Bigfoot Research Center, where myself and my co-authors went out in the woods with them in East Texas, and they were trying to call in a Bigfoot. And what they mean by calling in is they play pre-recorded sounds that are either of animals in distress or some sounds that are supposed to be of Bigfoot screaming that they've received from other Bigfoot investigators. And in the middle of the night, they play these screams. I've just shuddered to think of what any campers around there would have thought about what we were doing. I have a feeling we may have been the source of some Bigfoot reports. But we sat in the woods in the dark at 3 in the morning, spread out in a circle around where the sound was playing, in the hopes that Bigfoot would walk past us and on its way to investigate these sounds coming from the tree. And the fascinating thing about doing this type of research is that you can compare what you're seeing in your own narrative, if you prefer, to the narrative that the people you're studying have of the events. Just to give an example, when I was with these Bigfoot hunters, and just to clarify the fact that these are very different people from your typical paranormalist or our stereotype of a paranormalist, I was out there in the woods with a bank manager, a computer programmer, and a brain surgeon. These were the three guys who all believe they've had a Bigfoot experience, have no patience for any other paranormal beliefs, and are trying to drag Bigfoot in to prove to the world that they're not crazy. And while I was following them in the woods while they were going to set up their what they call a call blaster to try to call in Bigfoot, all of a sudden they stopped and they were smelling this strange smell, and they stopped and asked me what did I smell, and there was a terrible smell going through the woods. I have no idea what it was. I have no idea what's in the Texas wood that can make smells. I have no idea if it was a corpse. And the leader, David, asked me, well, what do you think that smell could be? And I told him, I don't know. Could that be a deer? And he said, does that smell like a deer to you? And I just responded, I don't know what a deer smells like, David. I couldn't tell you. He said, does it smell like a boar? And I said, well, I don't know, David. I don't know what a boar smells like. And he just looked at me and said, well, what do you think it could be then? And as it turns out, the Texas Bigfoot Research Center put up their own recounting of that evening on their website. So it gives us a fascinating chance to see what our experience was versus how they framed that experience. And in their discussion of that night, they count that encounter as a potential encounter with Sasquatch, because they believe Sasquatch has a very bad smell, and they think that probably that was a Sasquatch kind of circling us on the trail. And that happened to me numerous times. And we were spent the night in the haunted coffee house. The psychics have a very different story of that night than we do. And so that's, to me, the important part of doing field work, is being able to see how the group you're studying frames that event, how they explain what they were doing versus what you actually saw while you were out there.
Yeah, I'm glad you didn't mention too much about the haunted coffee house. You actually start the book off with that story, and that narrative is woven throughout the rest of the book at various points in time. And I think we need to let our readers, or our listeners here, go out and get your book and read to find out what happened. Because the description of the haunted coffee house and the characters involved in that whole field research are just absolutely fascinating. It was really gripping how that was written up, and we'll have to let folks find out for themselves what actually happened there.
Well, I can give a quick plug for it, which is just that we spent the night in a house that was supposedly infested with 150 demons. So that should be maybe wet their whistle to read this story.
Yeah, but not just any house. It's a coffee house, right?
It's a coffee house.
Yeah, that they sell coffee on a regular basis. And this is down in Houston or?
In Jefferson, Texas, which is a town that's in deep East Texas on the bayous.
Okay. Yeah, and also people should know this in terms of Bigfoot, too. You get images of Texas as West Texas, open plains, scrub brush area. But if you've ever been to Texas, East Texas is heavily wooded, and you know, you start getting into very close to Louisiana, and you got bayous as well.
Mm-hmm. So, that's correct.
And I'm just curious, is that where most of the Bigfoot hunters spend their time in Eastern Texas as compared to Western Texas?
That's right, that most of the Bigfoot sightings in Texas come from, as you correctly described, and I'm from the Northwest. I had no sense that Texas was like this coming down, but if you get about an hour east of Dallas, it becomes heavily wooded with bayous and swamps, and the population is very small. So that's where most of the sightings and reports and most of the Bigfoot hunts go on in Texas.
Yeah, which I guess in terms of, you know, the mysteries of it, too. Here in the Pacific Northwest, where it's very big, there's lots of unexplored territory, thickly wooded area. So that's kind of the area where all this stuff tends to occur. What other interesting things happen to you in your field work that stand out in your mind?
Sure. I spent several years on and off engaging in or observing a support group for people who believe they've been abducted by aliens. And that was very interesting, just to, again, see how these people make sense of their lives, how they deal with this fact that they believe they've been abducted and their families think that they're crazy. And one of the interesting parts of that experience was they strongly believed I had been abducted by aliens. And that helped me understand how they were able to continue this belief without really any physical evidence.
Well, what gave them that belief?
Their belief is that that the aliens, when they abduct you, they're able to erase your memory entirely.
Mm-hmm.
And all that you're left with is some sort of free-floating fear of the location where it happened, or nightmares that you have about weird people coming into your room. And the way you're supposed to recover the memories that you've been abducted is through hypnosis. So the leaders of these UFO abduction support groups use hypnotic regression techniques to try to bring out these stories. And because you do not have to have had any sort of memory or any belief that this has happened to you, because the aliens will have erased all those memories, that means that anyone who wanders into their circle is a potential abductee. And so they really strongly believe that the only reason that I would want to study them is that I probably had a hidden alien abduction experience that I hadn't recovered yet. And I have a scar on my pinky that I have no idea where I got it from. Probably got bitten by a dog when I was a kid or something. And at one point, the leader of the group examined my hand when she was getting frustrated with me, because time after time after time, I say, I understand what you're saying, but I have not been abducted by aliens. She observed my hands and found that scar and looked very knowingly at the other members of the group and winked. Said, well, you have been abducted. It'll just be a matter of time before you realize it.
Mm-hmm.
So that's an interesting mechanism by which these UFO abductees can sustain their belief. They don't need to have seen a UFO in front of other witnesses. They don't need to have captured an alien. That they believe these aliens have the power to erase their memories, even to erase scarring. Or some of these abductees I met believe that they've had hybrid children, meaning they believe the aliens have impregnated them and taken the babies out later to keep on their spaceships. And they believe the aliens have the power to fix your body such that it will not be clear that you were pregnant. And they also believe the aliens are powerful enough to make their behavior appear as if it's an ordinary event. For example, some of these abductees believe that the aliens will put implants in their body, which are small devices used to track them over time. And some abductees have pulled things out of their bodies, such as little bits of glass that look like maybe a part of a Coke bottle, and believe that the aliens, in fact, make their implants look like earthly garbage or glass, so that we won't know when we found an implant. So what's interesting about studying these groups is understanding how they, and this is very similar to religious groups too, how they explain how they view the world, how they explain the situation, explain what's happening to them in a way that fits their belief system.
How do they react with others around them? I mean, this is one of the things that I'm fascinated with. It's not as if these people go out advertising that they've been abducted by UFOs or they've seen Bigfoot or such. But, you know, as you mentioned earlier, they tend to be rather reluctant in terms of sharing their beliefs, which I could only imagine makes it very difficult to find others similar to them, and probably gives them a sense that they are alone in their belief systems.
That's true, and that's, again, one of the things that interests me about the paranormal, is that particularly these paranormal experiences that are focused around experiences, the belief you've been abducted by aliens, the belief that you've seen Bigfoot, the belief that you've seen a ghost, particularly with UFOs and Bigfoot and other forms of paranormal experiences like ritual abuse claims, you've started to see lower levels of organization than you see in a true religious organization, that these people are starting to find each other, that abduction therapists will advertise their services, and after a while they will start to have this loosely formed organization around them of fellow abductees, and those abductees start to develop a unified set of beliefs about who the aliens are and what they want. And same with the Bigfoot groups. These people who have experienced Bigfoot start to form these groups and develop their own sets of beliefs about what Bigfoot is. Some Bigfoot groups believe that Bigfoot is simply an undiscovered monkey. Other Bigfoot groups believe that Bigfoot is some sort of nature spirit or from a flying saucer himself or itself. So, again, this is what interests me about these groups, is watching them over time to see if they start to become more and more organized. Because the point that they're at now is the point that Stark and Bainbridge talked about long ago in The Future of Religion. These loosely organized groups that we often call client phenomena, where there's a leader who in a certain sense is the expert, who knows how to regress you hypnotically to recover the alien memories, or is some sort of expert on Bigfoot or extra-dimensional phenomena if they believe Bigfoot comes from another dimension. But they don't truly have the power of a religious leader, in the sense that members will come and go, that organization is not as tight, and there's not as many restrictions and costs as there are in true religious organizations.
Mm-hmm. And it must be true today, too, with the interwebs, that it's much easier to organize these because there's a degree of anonymity out there that you can, you know, seek out other individuals saying, hey, I think I've been abducted by a UFO, and just
right.
Put that out there without any face-to-face contact with anybody. So one would wonder if the internet age has given rise to stronger organizational forms among these groups than, say, back in the 1970s or so.
Well, I would agree with you completely, and I would also say that in general, and you mentioned this in your opening comments, that our culture has become much more open to paranormal phenomena. So it's much easier for people to find ways to organize and get together now than ever before. When you and I were growing up, if we had an interest in the paranormal, we had maybe one option, so a show such as In Search Of.
Right.
Which was one of my favorite shows as a little kid, In Search Of. And that was the only place that you could go on television and find stories about this. And,
yeah, I agree with you. Yeah, and it was with Leonard Nimoy, right?
With Leonard Nimoy.
Canceled Star Trek, they had to get my Spock fix somehow.
Well, and here's my, just to give you, again, we're talking about the relationship between the paranormal and religion. I was a Catholic growing up, and our Catholic Mass, my parents went on Saturday, and it just happened to be the same time In Search Of was on. And that was so devastating to me that I would miss the episode on Bigfoot at the time to go to Mass. I would always try to convince my parents to go Sunday morning so I wouldn't have to miss in search of. So I always, I guess I had that conflict in my own life that some people do.
Yeah, some of our younger listeners should know, too, that we didn't have DVRs back then. So
that's right.
If you missed it, that you had to wait until it came back in syndication.
But just to give you an example of what I mean by just the culture moving in this direction is I've been studying these types of beliefs for over 20 years, and when I first started studying these UFO groups, I would be asked to come give talks at different universities for different classes on UFO beliefs. And when I was talking about UFO abductions and that people actually believe they'd had these experiences, I was telling people for the first time. People had no idea what an alien was supposed to look like. I would draw on the board or bring busts that people had made of the aliens that supposedly abducted them. I would talk about the experience. Now, if I go into a class or go give a lecture about the paranormal, I can pick any random person out of the room, and they can give me a perfect abduction experience and draw what an alien's supposed to look like on the board. And so that has multiple effects. One, it has an effect on the number of people who are claiming these experiences, because it also has an effect on the subculture itself, because they've coalesced over time, and popular culture has coalesced around a particular abduction narrative, and that narrative didn't used to be there. Stories used to be all over the map. And what that allows the group to do is also it helps them move forward, because they can say that these abductions must be real because everyone is telling the same story.
Right.
And that didn't used to be the case.
Hmm. Well, we have about 5 minutes left here, and I made a promise at the beginning of the podcast that we would talk a little bit about another endeavor that you're involved in, and that is being the manager of web development for something known as the Association for Religious Data Archives. And this is pitched largely as a scholarly resource that you can get databases and such, but as I have watched it develop over the years, it's really become a tool that the general public can use to go and explore religious phenomena and religious beliefs and such. Tell us a little bit about what the ARDA, as it is known by its acronym is.
Sure. Well, first of all, it's www.thearda.com. Unfortunately, there's an American Rescue Dog Association that has ARDA.com, so we can't use that. But,
we'll make sure that we put a link up on our website.
Okay, great. What the ARDA is meant to be is we're trying to democratize access to quality data on religion. And what we mean by that is that over the years, myself and Roger Finke have been collecting every survey that we can find that includes religion content and archiving them permanently on the website. You can go to the ARDA. Currently, we have over 550 different surveys. Any one of those surveys, you can view the full details of how the survey was conducted. You can view a full code book online in complete question wording. That's very important to us. So this isn't something where you download the data and then have to look through a large manual of arcane codes to figure out what these things mean. Complete question wording, complete category labels on every item. You can perform some simple analyses right online. So if you're interested in a question, you can just click on it, and you can see crosstabs by pre-selected independent variables that we've chosen. Every file, we've selected the key demographics. Just click on a variable. You can immediately see how its basic frequencies and how it breaks down. And you can download any one of those files for free in multiple different formats. So the site is completely free because we don't want there to be any barriers towards people using quality data. In addition to that data archive, which I would call the heart of the site, we have multiple other different ways to explore religion. And many of those are very useful in the classroom and very useful for students who are getting started with research, very useful for the press and the general public. For example, we have a feature called Quick Stats, where you can go onto our Quick Stats feature and you can view hundreds of different topics. And for example, you can, if you're interested in abortion attitudes in the United States, if you're interested in subjects such as who believes in Bigfoot in the United States, or how often do people pray, or how many people believe in God, you click on that Quick Stat and we will have automatically selected from the best survey that we had, meaning the most recent, well-renowned national random sample, we will show you immediately the results for that item. We will also show you crosstabs by demographics. We'll show you trends over time right there if we have them. So if it's a question that's been asked over the years, you can see trends right there. So it's an excellent way for people to just explore their ideas right online before they even download the data and start playing with it themselves. We also have an extensive amount of information on cross-national trends in religion. You can view a report for online for every country, where we show you details on religious freedom in that country, adherence rates in that country. If there has been survey data in that country, we show you right there how people responded to key items. We also have a learning center where if you are teaching about religion in a class, or perhaps you're teaching a sociology of religion class, you can download a learning module which actually walks students through exploring live data on the topic of interest. We have dozens of those, ranging everything from creating a general religious landscape of the United States, very broad in that sense, to very specific topics such as religion and music and religion and crime. So the site is meant to be a place where serious researchers, the press, students, religious leaders can go and very quickly find the information that they need.
I should add to this. I know that some of our listeners might be a little bit wary when they hear the word analysis or crosstab. If you go to that website, it's really fun to play around with, and it's so easy to use, and you can get these maps in color and that anybody can basically understand, and it's such an incredibly good resource. I know we're trying to pitch this podcast to a number of homeschoolers as well as high schools and college classes, and just be aware of that this resource is out there, because it is an amazing tool, and as you mentioned, it's all for free, and this is a great learning
device. Well, and one other pitch I'll make for it as well that's very fun to play with, and is that you can go to the site, type in your zip code, and it will give you a religious profile for where you live. That's all you have to do. You don't have to go and select data files or do an analysis. You simply type in your zip code, hit go, and you will see a very detailed religious breakdown of where you are. It'll show all the denominations that are operating in your area. It'll show you how many members they currently have. It'll show you how they've changed over the last two decades. So you can see for your area which religious groups are growing, which are losing members, which are staying the same, who has the most membership right now. And it's very fun just to explore different parts of the country and see what the religious profile looks like.
Absolutely. It's actually more fun than playing Space Invaders online, I found out. I've been on it several hours just, tinkering around with no particular goal in mind, just learning a lot of different stuff. So, Chris, I want to thank you for being part of creating the ARDA and maintaining it. It's a wonderful resource. And I also want to thank you for your time today talking about the paranormal. Hope to have you back soon on Research on Religion.
All right. Well, you're welcome. Thank you for having me.
Thank you for listening to Research on Religion. To learn more about today's topic, participate in a discussion about what you've heard, or browse other podcasts, please visit our website at www.researchonreligion.org. And if you like what we're doing, please tell a friend. We'd appreciate the company. See you next week.